This is Backstory, the show that looks to the past to explain the America of today. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th century history guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, 19th century history guy.
And I'm Brian Bellow, history guy of the 20th century. Today on the show, the history of healthcare in America.
We're going to take another call now. It's from Brenda out in Des Moines, Iowa. Brenda, welcome to Backstory.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we're talking about healthcare, which is on everybody's minds now, and I'm sure on yours too. That's why you called.
Yes, it is. I wanted to get your opinion on what you might call rising expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said in one of my entries on your website, I'm an asthmatic, but it's not the sort of thing you can tell by looking at me. And yeah. I know that, you know, medical technology and research has gotten to the point where there are drugs to treat it now. Excuse me. But, you know, that was not always the case.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to hear from you about how, you know, we expect more. It's like our standards
right.
have gotten better.
That's a great question. And I'm curious, I mean, Ed, when did actual expectations for health begin to rise?
See, I was going to say that it's much more in your period than in mine. Because, you know, in the 19th century, there were really no medical breakthroughs all the way through the era of the Civil War. It was not until, you know, pasteurization and, mm-hmm. and some of those kind of more public health discoveries in the later 19th century that you started seeing things. And you know, they didn't even know that mosquitoes caused illness. They thought it was the miasma, you know, something lifting out of the swamps. So my sense is that it was not really until the early 20th century that you'd have seen very great breakthroughs in health expectations.
Yeah, I would agree, Ed, although I'd back up a little bit and go back to your point about public health, because,
yeah.
you know, public health, improving it in the late 19th century, right on the edge of your period of mind, it entailed massive investments in water and sewer systems and cleaning up cities. And I got to believe that people weren't willing to spend that kind of money, those kinds of tax dollars, if they didn't have great expectations for improving health. Would you?
Yeah,
would you agree?
You know, I'd say by the last decade uh-huh. of the 19th century, but you were still having, as late as the 1870s, horrific outbreaks of yellow fever and, you know, other diseases that we've now sort of mastered that were complete mysteries to people. And they could just do the same thing they did back in the 18th century of quarantines
yeah.
and so forth. So you're right, Brian. They began to clean things up.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it still wasn't really part of a comprehensive understanding of where
right.
disease came from.
Well, yeah. I mean, like you say, some of it is, you know, we didn't know about disease or understand it. So, you know, this happened. You know, life was, as was it Hobbes that put it, nasty, brutish, and short, and that's
yeah, exactly.
just the way it is. And then we start to get better technology and understand how to do things. And then pretty soon it becomes almost what the Catholics might call a sin of omission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, now that we can do surgery, it's terrible to let some child with a cleft palate just go. You know, if a woman has breast cancer, it's almost expected to be able to do a reconstructive surgery after the mastectomy and that kind of thing. And, I mean, the child with the cleft palate is going to have trouble with swallowing and speaking and so forth, but, you know, the child isn't going to necessarily starve. And it's almost like, well, if you have the ability to help somebody, then isn't it almost wrong not to?
Yeah. Brenda, I think what I hear you saying is that there is an idea of the normal. The normal is the normative. That is, we have both a focus on the individual, yet we measure ourselves against some kind of universal yardstick. And that is where you get to your rising expectations, because we keep ticking up the yardstick, because we keep saying, hey, this is the way we all ought to be. And all public health now is essentially a bully pulpit in which people tell us that we should be thinner, we should be eating better, we should be aspiring to a better kind of healthier life.
And even more than that, Peter, this is the century in which plastic surgery is really soaring.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we have not
point.
Only the expectation of health, but of beauty. You know, they couldn't even perform the most basic surgeries without killing people back in the 19th century. And now, with all the anesthetics and anesthesia and everything, you know, it seems a routine thing to be, you know, slicing people's faces and that sort of thing.
Which is why we're on radio, Brent.
But anyway, that's why I think Brenda's question is actually profound. I think it's not merely the expectation of better health, mm-hmm. but the expectation of everything. And one reason the current health debate's so heated is that the stakes seem so high now because what we expect from health seems virtually unlimited.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, guys, we got another call. It's from Brent in Cleveland, Ohio. Brent, welcome to Backstory.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What's on your mind?
Well, as a native Clevelander and somebody who's really lived all over the country in sort of the urban north and the rural south, I'm really interested in the way people in those areas of the country are likely to react to the healthcare debate today. And I wonder if the way they've reacted is colored by their political and, you know, cultural histories that are tied to the regions. And I guess I'll get more specific. Mm-hmm. I know that in the wake of the Civil War, the federal government gave pensions to Union soldiers and their families, but not to Confederate soldiers and their families. And so what I'm wondering is whether that legacy has shaped the way people in the rural South and in the North views the federal government and its efforts in healthcare, and whether there have been sort of disparities at other points along the way in healthcare and pensions and all that that are shaped by north-south or urban-rural disparities, really.
So, yeah, Brent, you want to know if regional differences explain some of the brouhaha over healthcare and whether we can give some historical perspective on this. What do you think, Ed? I mean, you're a Southern boy.
I am, and that was many interesting questions together, you know, and you're exactly right that there was a lot of resentment for a long time that a lot of men with missing limbs and disfigured faces really had no support from the federal government at the very time in the 1890s in particular when people were growing old. And the state governments in the South ended up spending a large part of their budgets for artificial limbs and care for the Confederate soldiers. And here in Richmond, there's a Confederate soldiers' home that private money would go in to do all these things. So you're exactly right in the analysis of it. And another way you're exactly right is the enormous health disparity between the North and the South today. If you look at maps of social well-being and various instances of maladies, the South is so much worse off than the rest of the country. And part of it is the Black Belt, so part of it's African-American population and the well-known neglect there. But another large part of it is Appalachia, where you have really great shortages there. But here's the paradox, Brent. The people who are most opposed to the health care plan do tend to live in the South and do tend to be people of economic need. But you find that those are the states, ironically, that actually get more from the federal government. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the liberal states, which are actually net payers to the federal government, are in support of health care.
So what I'm kind of wondering about is whether the lack of federal expenditures has maybe even caused some of the more recent federal expenditures. Maybe if the federal government had actually helped out with some of the needy in the 1890s, that maybe the states wouldn't have had to have spent so much and they might have been able to put some dollars into development.
Well, I think that the things that the federal government wanted to give money for and that the southern states resisted actually would have helped the Black population. And for well-known reasons, the southern states did not want to open the door to federal involvement in their affairs because they were flouting the 15th Amendment. So I don't think that it's the lack of earlier investment, except maybe in the New Deal. The irony is, we have irony and paradox, so this is like a bonus
go for it,
answer of Southern history, you know, is that Southerners, Black and white, pride themselves on not needing doctors as much, right? And it's a part of the cultural tradition that you basically have to be really bad shape before you'll go to a doctor. And that does, to me, look like a cultural thing. It looks like an aversion to expertise or meddling or that sort of thing.
Yeah, except if you're from South Florida.
Yeah.
Come on. That's the highest per capita use of medical services in the entire country is in South Florida. Three times per capita that what it is in Buffalo, New York, in Miami.
Wow. Well, I mean, that's so far south, it's north.
Well, I know. It's not really part of the South. But I don't know. Brian, what do you think about this? Can we trace that tradition back, this kind of willingness to look to government for solutions? Is that part of the civic culture of the North as opposed to the South?
Well, I think that it is. But the 20th century, as it tends to do, guys, complicates things a lot. Because Brent started out by asking about the implications of war and the military on social and health provision. And when you run that forward into the 20th century, what you get is what Ed was alluding to. That is increasing expenditures that are going to the South. And that's in the form of military bases, but that's also in the form of Americans serving their country. And after World War II, the only Americans, the only large group of Americans that received regular and pretty good medical care from the federal government were veterans. Mm-hmm. And they received it through these veterans facilities. But this is where the ironies and the paradoxes of the South come into play, because those facilities also discriminated against African Americans and African American veterans. So even though they were entitled to these medical services, they found it a lot harder to receive them. But this is when I think the South started benefiting from federal largesse in health care, perhaps in a disproportionate way.
Yeah, and Brian, isn't it? Don't you think it's also true that Americans have a genius for feeding at the federal trough and then denying that they're dependent?
Oh, no question about it.
Yeah, I heard a guy the other day say, you know, I don't know why these people have to have the government. He said, back when I was poor, I was on welfare and food stamps, and I never asked the government for anything.
That's great. Well,
so what do you think, Brent? Did we get anywhere close to answering your question in a persuasive way?
Well, you sure revealed the paradox that I was trying to get to. How about that?
All right. Okay. That's a very polite and ironic answer.
That's the sign of being sophisticated historian, Brent. Welcome to the club. Great to talk with you.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks a lot.
All right.
Bye-bye.
So it seems to me, Brian, that, you know, in the current debate, people who are trying to sell the nation on this sort of public health care system keep talking about efficiency and cost and all those kinds of things, rather than much of a morally charged responsibility. You know, it shifts over to a kind of almost cost accounting model rather than a sort of a more communitarian model.
That's such a good and important point, Ed. You know, when Truman proposed health care and when Roosevelt was kind of building up to it in the 30s, they both talked in terms of obligations, the reciprocity of citizenship.
Right.
And of course, it was a time when Americans were asked to make huge sacrifices for their country. And I don't mean to demean the sacrifices that our fighting men are making and women are making today in Iraq and Afghanistan, but they are a sliver of the American population. Truman was addressing a population that had just sacrificed collectively. And that's how there was broad support for providing good medical care to millions and millions of returning veterans, because they had sacrificed. The relationship between the obligation to government and the benefits that one could expect back from government were crystal clear in those days, or at least as clear as they get in a democratic republic.
So let's imagine what it looks like to the many Americans who oppose anything like mm-hmm. this and the energy that they bring to it. You could argue that because of the history that Brian has told us about how insurance became linked to employment, it's not unlike the health care given to returning GIs, mm-hmm. is that they had earned it. I have earned this. This
right.
is a part of my benefits
right.
that I get. And that what you want to do is give away something for nothing. Now, even Social Security, right, is a yeah. return for
oh,
service.
It was totally presented as that.
Yeah.
Right? So I think that what we have here is the lack of a mechanism to explain how somebody deserves health care merely for being a part of the community, merely for being an American.
Yeah. So, Ed, you would say at the end of the day that we end up with ideological and even rhetorical problems about how we describe and misdescribe the world we live in.
Yeah, because we don't really have a language that really just is unabashed communitarianism. Not communism, not socialism, just collective responsibility.
Well, we have nationalism. I think that may be the closest we get, and that's why wartime is so crucial.
Yes, but you know, guys, we did have that language back in your century because everybody understood that somebody who had a communicable disease, whether they had a job or not, whether they were a brave soldier or not, could get everybody else sick. And so the steps that needed to be taken were collective. The language was collective.
Mm-hmm. So we have progressed to the point where we feel safe from other people's misfortunes.
Exactly.
And the illnesses all seem internal. You know, the ones that we can't lick, right. Heart disease, cancer.
Cancer, right.
Yeah. All those things seem Alzheimer's. Like something that well up from within.
Right. And maybe even our fault. Right?
Yeah.
We didn't eat right.
Smoking.
We didn't exercise.
I mean, look at the way it is today with swine flu.
Yeah.
Okay? Nobody's blaming anybody else for getting swine flu. They're just saying it's an epidemic. It's almost so it's by the changing nature of the diseases that are killing us as well as the changing nature of the technology by which those diseases are fixed.
But it's because we've done so well in general
mm-hmm. yeah.
at dealing with those communicable diseases.
Yeah.
Right. So we're left with those individual right. diseases. And that really plays into Americans' pre-existing condition, if you will, of seeing things through individualistic terms.
Well, Brian, I think everything you've said has made a lot of sense, except I think what's really coming out here is that the sense of the individual and of the individual's health, the individual's body, this individualistic focus is really something that has developed in the 20th century. It's not, we can think back into the 18th century and think about Adam Smith and the market, and we can blame all these Enlightenment thinkers for this modern solipsism and narcissism and obsession with self. But the idea that Smith and other moral philosophers of the Enlightenment had is of human nature to be naturally sociable. That is, that we're drawn to others and to right. do well for others, to take care of others, with the family being the model or the paradigm for the society as a whole. The point of market transactions is not the aggrandizement of the individual, right. but that's a byproduct of it. It's to promote the wealth of the nation and the health of the nation, you might say.
You know, Peter, even if I disagreed with you, I couldn't argue because we've run out of time again. But remember, our conversation is always going on at our website. Please pay us a visit and tell us whether the history of healthcare in America makes you optimistic or pessimistic about the path ahead of us.
You can find us at backstoryradio.org. You can listen to all our past shows there and sign up for our free newsletter, Don't Be a Stranger.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore, with help from Lydia Wilson and Bart Elmore.
Jamal Milner mastered the show, and Gabby Alter wrote our theme. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major production support for Backstory with American History Guys is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the University of Richmond, Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs, and an anonymous donor.
Support also comes from James Madison's Montpelier, Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, and J.M. Weinberg.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond.